Chapter 6. Driving his Volkswagen bus away, Andrew Gill caught one last sight of the woman in the paint-spattered jeans and sweater whom he had just let off. He watched her as she trudged barefoot along the road, and then he lost her as his bus passed a bend. He did not know her name, but it seemed to him that she was about the prettiest woman he had ever seen, with her red hair and small, delicately formed feet. And, he thought to himself in a daze, he and she had just now made love in the back of his VW bus. It was, to him, a pageant of figments, the woman and the great explosions from the south that had torn up the countryside and raised the sky of gray overhead. He knew that it was war of some sort, or at least a bad event of some modern kind, entirely new to the world and to his experience. He had, that morning, driven from his shop in Petaluma to West Marin, to deliver to the pharmacy at Point Reyes Station a load of imported English briar pipes. His business was fine liquors, especially wines, and tobaccos, everything for the serious smoker, including little nickel-plated devices for cleaning pipes and tamping the tobacco down. Now, as he drove, he wondered how his shop was. Had the event encompassed the Petaluma area? "I had better get the hell back there and see how it is," he said to himself. And then he thought once again of the small red-haired woman in the jeans who had hopped into his bus, or allowed him to draw her into it. He no longer was certain which had happened, and it seemed to him that he ought to drive after her and make sure she was all right. "Does she live around here?" he asked himself. "And how do I find her again?" Already he wanted to find her again. He had never met or seen anyone like her. And did she do it because of shock? He wondered. Was she in her right mind at the time? Had she ever done such a thing before? And more important, would she ever do it again? However, he kept on going, not turning back. His hands felt numb, as if they were lifeless. He was exhausted. "I know there's going to be other bombs or explosions," he said to himself. "They landed one on the Bay Area, and they'll keep shooting them off at us." In the sky overhead, he saw now flashes of light in quick succession, and then, after a time, a distant rumble seized his bus and made it buck and quake. "Bombs going off up there," he decided. "Maybe our defenses. But there will be more getting through." Then, too, there was the radiation. Drifting overhead now, the clouds of what he knew to be deadly radiation passed on north, and did not seem to be low enough yet to affect life on the surface, his life and that of the bushes and trees along the road. "Maybe we'll wither and die in another few days," he thought. "Maybe it's only a question of time. Is it worth hiding? Should I head north, try to escape?" But the clouds were moving north. "I better stay here," he said to himself, "and try to find some local shelter. I think I read somewhere once that this is a protected spot. The winds blow on past West Marin and go inland, toward Sacramento." And still he saw no one, only the girl, the only person he had seen since the first great bomb and the realization of what it meant. No cars, no people on foot. "They'll be showing up from down below pretty soon," he reasoned, "by the thousands, and dying as they go. Refugees. Maybe I should get ready to help." But all he had in his VW truck were pipes and cans of tobacco and bottles of California wine from small vintners. He had no medical supplies, and no know-how. And anyhow, he was over 50 years old, and he had a chronic heart problem called paroxysmal tachycardia. It was a wonder, in fact, that he had not had an attack of it, back there when he was making love with the girl. "My wife and the two kids," he thought. "Maybe they're dead. I just have to get back to Petaluma. A phone call? Absurd, the phones are certainly out." And still he drove on, pointlessly, not knowing where to go or what to do, not knowing how much danger he was in, if the attack by the enemy was over or if this was just the start. "I could be wiped out any second," he realized. But he felt safe in the familiar VW bus, which he had owned for 6 years now. It had not been changed by what had happened. It was sturdy and reliable, whereas, he felt, the world, the rest of things, all had undergone a permanent, dreadful metamorphosis. He did not wish to look. "What if Barbara and the boys are dead?" he asked himself. Oddly, the idea carried with it the breath of release. A new life, as witness me meeting that girl. The old is all over. Won't tobacco and wines be very valuable now? Don't I, in actual fact, have a fortune here in this bus? I don't have to go back to Petaluma ever. I can disappear, and Barbara will never be able to find me. He felt buoyed up, cheerful now. But that would mean, God forbid, he would have to abandon his shop, and that was a horrible notion, overlain with a sense of peril and isolation. I can't give that up, he decided. That represents 20 years of gradually building up a good customer relationship, of genuinely finding out people's wants and serving them. However, he thought, those people are possibly dead now, along with my family. I have to face it, everything has changed, not merely the things I don't care for. Driving slowly along, he tried to cogitate over each possibility, but the more he cogitated, the more confused and uneasy he became. I don't think any of us will survive, he decided. We probably all have radiation exposure. My relationship with that girl is the last notable event in my life, and the same for her. She is no doubt doomed, too. Christ, he thought bitterly. Some numbskull in the Pentagon is responsible for this. We should have had 2 or 3 hours warning, and instead we got 5 minutes, at the most. He felt no animosity toward the enemy now. He felt only a sense of shame, a sense of betrayal. Those military saps in Washington are probably safe and sound down in their concrete bunkers, like Adolf Hitler at the end, he decided, and we're left up here to die. It embarrassed him. It was awful. Suddenly he noticed that on the seat beside him lay 2 empty shoes, 2 worn slippers. The girl's. He sighed, feeling weary. Some memento, he thought with gloom. And then he thought in excitement, it's not a memento, it's a sign, for me to stay here in West Marin, to begin all over again here. If I stay here, I'll run into her again, I know I will. It's just a question of being patient. That's why she left her shoes. She already knew it, that I'm just beginning my life here, that after what's happened, I won't, can't leave. The hell with my shop, with my wife and children in Petaluma. As he drove along, he began to whistle with relief and glee. There was no doubt in the mind of Bruno Bluthgeld now. He saw the unceasing stream of cars all going one way, going north toward the highway that emptied into the countryside. Berkeley had become a sieve, out of which at every hole leaked the people pressing upward from beneath, the people from Oakland and San Leandro and San Jose. They were all passing through along the streets that had become one-way streets now. It's not me, Dr. Bluthgeld said to himself as he stood on the sidewalk, unable to cross the street to get to his own car. And yet, he realized, even though it is real, even though it is the end of everything, the destruction of the cities and the people on every side, I am responsible. He thought, in some way, I made it happen. I must make amends, he told himself. He clasped his hands together, tense with concern. It must unhappen, he realized. I must shut it back off. What has happened is this, he decided. They were developing their arrangements to injure me, but they hadn't counted on my ability, which in me seems to lie partly in the subconscious. I have only a dubious control over it. It emanates from suprapersonal levels, what Jung would call the collective unconscious. They didn't take into account the almost limitless potency of my reactive psychic energy, and now it's flowed back out at them in response to their arrangements. I didn't will it to. It simply followed a psychic law of stimulus and response, but I must take moral responsibility for it anyhow, because it is I, the greater I, the self, which transcends the conscious ego. I must wrestle with it, now that it's done its work contra the others. Surely it has done enough. Isn't, in fact, the damage too great? But no, it was not too great, in the pure physical sense, the pure realm of action and reaction. A law of conservation of energy, a parity, was involved. His collective unconscious had responded commensurate to the harm intended by the others. Now, however, it was time to atone for it. That was, logically, the next step. It had expended itself. Or had it? He felt doubt and a deep confusion. Had the reactive process, his metabiological defense system, completed its cycle of response? Or was there more? He sniffed the atmosphere, trying to anticipate. The sky, an admixture of particles, debris light enough to be carried. What lay behind it, concealed as in a womb? The womb, he thought, a pure essence within me as I stand here debating. I wonder if these people driving by in these cars, these men and women with their blank faces, I wonder if they know who I am. Are they aware that I am the omphalos, the center of all this cataclysmic disruption? He watched the passing people, and presently he knew the answer. They were quite aware of him, that he was the source of this all, but they were afraid to attempt any injury in his direction. They had learned their lesson. Raising his hand toward them, he called,
"Don't worry. There won't be any more. I promise."
Did they understand and believe him? He felt their thoughts directed at him, their panic, their pain, and also their hatred toward him, now held in abeyance by the tremendous demonstration of what he could accomplish. "I know how you feel," he thought back, or perhaps said aloud, he could not tell which. "You have learned a hard, bitter lesson, and so have I. I must watch myself more carefully. In the future I must guard my powers with a greater awe, a greater reverence at the trust placed in my hands." "Where should I go now?" he questioned himself. "Away from here, so that this will gradually die down of its own accord? For their sakes, it would be a good idea, a kind, humane, equitable solution." "Can I leave?" he asked himself. "Of course." Because the forces at work were, to at least some extent, disposable, he could summon them, once he was aware of them, as he was now. What had been wrong before had simply been his ignorance of them. Perhaps through intense psychoanalysis he would have gotten to them in time, and this great disturbance might have been avoided. But too late to worry about that now. He began to walk back the way he had come. "I can pass over this traffic and absent myself from this region," he assured himself. To prove it, he stepped from the curb, out into the solid stream of cars. Other people were doing so, too, other individuals on foot, many of them carrying household goods, books, lamps, even a bird in a cage or a cat. He joined them, waving to them to indicate that they should cross with him, follow him, because he could pass on through at will. The traffic had almost halted. It appeared to be due to cars forcing their way in from a side street ahead, but he knew better. That was only the apparent cause. The genuine cause was his desire to cross. An opening between two cars lay directly ahead, and Dr. Bluthgeld led the group of people on foot across to the far side. "Where do I want to go?" he asked himself, ignoring the thanks of the people around him. They were all trying to tell him how much they owed him. "Out into the country? Away from the city?" "I am dangerous to the city," he realized. "I should go 50 or 60 miles to the east, perhaps all the way to the Sierras, to some remote spot. West Marin. I could go back up there. Bonnie is up there. I could stay with her and George. I think that would be far enough away. But if it is not, I will continue on. I must absent myself from these people, who do not deserve to be punished any further. If necessary, I will continue on forever. I will never stop in one place." "Of course," he realized, "I can't get to West Marin by car. None of these cars are moving or are ever going to move again. The congestion is too great, and the Richardson Bridge is certainly gone. I will have to walk. It will take days, but eventually I will make it there. I will go up to the Black Point Road, up toward Vallejo, and follow the route across the sloughs. The land is flat. I can cut directly across the fields if necessary. In any case, it's a penance for what I've done. This will be a voluntary pilgrimage, a way of healing the soul." He walked, and as he did so, he concentrated on the damage about him. He viewed it with the idea of healing it, of restoring the city, if at all possible, to its pure state. When he came to a building that had collapsed, he paused and said,
"Let this building be restored."
When he saw injured people, he said,
"Let these people be adjudged innocent and so forgiven."
Each time, he made a motion with his hand which he had devised. It indicated his determination to see that things such as this did not recur. "Perhaps they have learned a permanent lesson," he thought. "They may leave me alone now." But, it occurred to him, perhaps they would go in the opposite direction. They would, after they had dragged themselves from the ruins of their houses, develop an even greater determination to destroy him. This might, in the long run, increase rather than dispel their animosity. He He felt frightened, thinking about their vengeance. Maybe I should go into hiding, he thought. Keep the name Mr. Tree, or use some other fictive name for purposes of concealment. Right now they are wary of me, but I'm afraid it will not last. And yet, even knowing that, he still continued to make his special sign to them as he walked along. He still bent his efforts to achieving a restoration for them. His own emotions contained no hostility. He was free of that. It was only they who harbored any hate. At the edge of the bay, Dr. Bluthgeld emerged from the traffic to see the white, shattered, glass-like city of San Francisco lying everywhere on the far side of the water. Nothing stood. Overhead, smoke and yellow fire manifested themselves in a way that he could not believe. It was as if the city had become a stick of stove wood, incinerated without leaving a trace. And yet there were people coming out of it. He saw on the water bobbing chunks. The people had floated every kind of object out and were clinging to them, trying to push across to Marin County. Dr. Bluthgeld stood there, unable to go on, his pilgrimage forgotten. First he had to cure them, and then, if possible, cure the city itself. He forgot his own needs. He concentrated on the city, using both hands, making new gestures which he had never hit on before. He tried everything, and after a long time he saw the smoke begin to clear. That gave him hope. But the people bobbing across, escaping, began to diminish in number. He saw fewer and fewer until the bay was empty of them, and only naked debris remained. So he concentrated then on saving the people themselves. He thought of the escape routes north, where the people should go and what they would need to find. Water, first of all, and then rations. He thought of the army bringing in supplies and the Red Cross. He thought of small towns in the country making their possessions available. Finally, what he willed began reluctantly to come to pass, and he remained where he was a long time, getting it to be. Things improved. The people found treatment for burns. He saw to that. He saw, too, to the healing of their great fear. That was important. He saw to the first glimmerings of their getting themselves established once more, in at least a rudimentary way. But curiously, at the same time that he devoted himself to improving their condition, he noticed to his surprise and shock that his own had deteriorated. He had lost everything in the service of the general welfare, because now his clothes were in rags, like sacks. His toes poked through his shoes. On his face a ragged beard hung down, a mustache had grown over his mouth, and his hair fell all the way over his ears and brushed his torn collar, and his teeth, even his teeth, were gone. He felt old and sick and empty, but nonetheless it was worth it. How long had he stood here, doing this job? The streams of cars had long since ceased. Only damaged, abandoned wrecks of autos lay along the freeway to his right. Had it been weeks? Possibly months. He felt hungry, and his legs trembled with the cold. So once more he began to walk. I gave them everything I had, he told himself, and, thinking that, he felt a little resentment, more than a trace of anger. What did I get back? I need a haircut and a meal and medical attention. I need a few things myself. Where can I get them? Now, he thought, I'm too tired to walk to Marin County. I'll have to stay here, on this side of the bay, for a while, until I can rest up and get my strength back. His resentment grew as he walked slowly along. But anyhow, he had done his job. He saw, not far ahead, a first aid station with rows of dingy tents. He saw women with armbands and knew they were nurses. He saw men with metal helmets carrying guns. Law and order, he realized. Because of my efforts, it's been reestablished here and there. They owe me a lot, but of course they don't acknowledge it. I'll let it pass, he decided. When he reached the first dingy tent, one of the men with guns stopped him. Another man, carrying a clipboard, approached. Where are you from? The man with the clipboard asked.
From Berkeley, he answered. Name? Mr. Jack Tree.
They wrote that down, then tore off a card and handed it to him. It had a number on it, and the two men explained that he should keep the number, because without it he could not obtain food rations. Then he was told that if he tried, or had tried, to collect rations at another relief station, he would be shot. The two men then walked off, leaving him standing there with his numbered card in his hand. Should I tell them that I did all this? He wondered. That I'm solely responsible and eternally damned for my dreadful sin in bringing this about? No, he decided, because if I do, they'll take my card back. I won't get any food ration. And he was terribly, terribly hungry. Now one of the nurses approached him, and in a matter-of-fact voice said, "Any vomiting, dizziness, change of color of the stool?" "No," he said. "Any superficial burns which have failed to heal?" He shook his head, "No." "Go over there," the nurse said, pointing, "and get rid of your clothing. They'll delouse you and shave your head, and you can get your shots there. We're out of the typhoid serum, so don't ask for that." To his bewilderment, he saw a man with an electric razor, powered by a gasoline generator, shaving the heads of men and women both. The people waited patiently in line. A sanitary measure? He wondered. I thought I had fixed that, he thought. Or did I forget about disease? Evidently I did. He began to walk in that direction, bewildered by his failure to have taken everything into account. I must have left out a variety of vital things, he realized, as he joined the line of people waiting to have their heads shaved. In the ruins of a cement basement of a house on Cedar Street in the Berkeley Hills, Stuart McCunchie spied something fat and gray that hopped from one split block and behind the next. He picked up his broom handle, one end came to a cracked, elongated point, and wriggled forward. The man with him in the basement, a sallow, lean man named Ken, who was dying of radiation exposure, said,
"You're not going to eat that."
"Sure I am,"
Stuart said, wriggling through the dust which had settled into the open, exposed basement, until he lay against a split block of cement. The rat, aware of him, squeaked with fear. It had come up from the Berkeley sewer, and now it wanted to get back. But he was between it and the sewer. Or, rather, he thought, between her and the sewer. It was no doubt a big female. The males were skinnier. The rat scurried in fright, and Stuart drove the sharp end of the stick into it. Again it squeaked, long and sufferingly. On the end of the stick it was still alive. It kept on squeaking. So he held it against the ground, held the stick down, and crushed its head with his foot.
"At least," the dying man with him said, "you can cook it."
"No,"
Stuart said, and seating himself, got out the pocket knife which he had found. It had been in the pants pocket of a dead schoolboy, and began skinning the rat. While the dying man watched with disapproval, Stuart ate the dead, raw rat.
"I'm surprised you don't eat me," the man said afterward.
"It's no worse than eating raw shrimp," Stuart said.
He felt much better now. It was his first food in days.
"Why don't you go looking for one of those relief stations that helicopter was talking about when it flew by yesterday?"
the dying man said.
"It said, or I understood it to say, that there's a station over near the Hillside Grammar School. That's only a few blocks from here. You could get that far."
"No,"
Stuart said.
"Why not?"
The answer, although he did not want to say it, was simply that he was afraid to venture out of the basement onto the street. He did not know why, except that there were things moving in the settling ash which he could not identify. He believed they were Americans, but possibly they were Chinese or Russians. Their voices sounded strange and echoey, even in daytime. And the helicopter, too. He was not certain about that. It could have been an enemy trick to induce people to come out and be shot. In any case, he still heard gunfire from the flat part of the city. The dim sound started before the sun rose and occurred intermittently until nightfall.
"You can't stay here forever,"
Ken said.
"It isn't rational."
He lay wrapped up in the blankets which had belonged to one of the beds in the house. The bed had been hurled from the house as the house disintegrated, and Stuart and the dying man had found it in the backyard. Its neatly tucked-in covers had been still on it, all in place, including its two duck-feather pillows. What Stuart was thinking was that in 5 days he had collected thousands of dollars in money from the pockets of dead people he had found in the ruins of houses along Cedar Street, from their pockets and from the houses themselves. Other scavengers had been after food, and different objects such as knives and guns, and it made him uneasy that he alone wanted money. He felt now that if he stirred forth, if he reached a relief station, he would discover the truth. The money was worthless. And if it was, he was a horse's ass for collecting it, and when he showed up at the relief station carrying a pillowcase full of it, everyone would jeer at him, and rightly so, because a horse's ass deserved to be jeered at. And also, no one else seemed to be eating rats. Perhaps there was a superior food available, of which he knew nothing. It sounded like him, down here eating something everyone else had discarded. Maybe there were cans of emergency rations being dropped from the air. Maybe the cans came down early in the morning while he was still asleep and got all picked up before he had a chance to see them. He had had for several days now a deep and growing dread that he was missing out, that something free was being dispensed, perhaps in broad daylight, to everyone but him. Just my luck, he said to himself, and he felt glum and bitter, and the rat, which he had just eaten, no longer seemed to surfeit as before. Hiding these last few days down in the ruined cement basement of the house on Cedar Street, Stuart had had a good deal of time to think about himself, and he had realized that it had always been hard for him to make out what other people were doing. It had only been by the greatest effort that he had managed to act as they acted, appear like them. It had nothing to do, either, with his being a Negro, because he had the same problem with black people as with white. It was not a social difficulty in the usual sense. It went deeper than that. For instance, Ken, the dying man lying opposite him. Stuart could not understand him. He felt cut off from him. Maybe that was because Ken was dying and he was not. Maybe that set up a barrier. The world was clearly divided into two new camps now. People who were getting weaker with each passing moment, who were perishing, and people like himself who were going to make it. There was no possibility of communication between them because their worlds were too different. And yet, that was not it only, between himself and Ken. There was still more, the same old problem that the bomb attack had not created but merely brought to the surface. Now the gulf was wider. It was obvious that he did not actually comprehend the meaning of most activities conducted around him. He had been brooding, for instance, about the yearly trip to the Department of Motor Vehicles for his auto license renewal. As he lay in the basement, it seemed to him more clearly each moment that the other people had gone to the Department of Motor Vehicles office over on Sacramento Street for a good reason. But he had gone because they had gone. He had, like a littler kid, merely tagged along. And now there was no one present to tag after. Now he was alone. And therefore he could not think up any action to follow. He could not make any decision or follow any plan for the life of him. So he simply waited, and as he waited, wondered about the copter, which flew overhead now and then, and about the vague shapes in the street, and more than anything else, if he was a horse's ass or not. And then, all at once, he thought of something. He remembered what Hoppy Harrington had seen in his vision at Fred's Fine Foods. Hoppy had seen him, Stuart McConchy, eating rats, but in the excitement and fear of all that had happened since, Stuart had forgotten. This, now, was what the folk he had seen. This was the vision, not the afterlife at all. God damn that little crippled freak, Stuart thought to himself, as he lay picking his teeth with a piece of wire. He was a fraud. He put something over on us. Amazing how gullible people are, he said to himself. We believed him, maybe because he's so peculiarly built anyhow. It seemed more credible with him being like he is, or was. He's probably dead now, buried down in the service department. Well, that's one good thing this war has done, wiped out all the freaks. But then, he realized, it's also brewed up a whole new batch of them. There'll be freaks strutting around for the next 1,000,000 years. It'll be Bluthgeld's paradise. In fact, he's probably quite happy right now, because this was really bomb testing. Ken stirred and murmured,
Could you be induced to crawl across the street? There's that corpse there, and it might have cigarettes on it.
Cigarettes, hell, Stuart thought. It probably has a wallet full of money. He followed the dying man's gaze and saw, sure enough, the corpse of a woman lying among the rubble on the far side. His pulse raced because he could see a bulging handbag still clutched. In a weary voice, Ken said,
Leave the money, Stuart. It's an obsession with you. A symbol of God knows what.
As Stuart crawled out from the basement, Ken raised his voice to call,
A symbol of the opulent society.
He coughed, retched.
And that's gone now,
he managed to add. Up yours, Stuart thought, as he crawled on across the street to the purse lying there. Sure enough, when he opened it, he found a wad of bills, ones and fives, and even a 20. There was also a Uno candy bar in the purse, and he got that, too. But as he crawled back to the basement, it occurred to him that the candy bar might be radioactive, so he tossed it away.
"The cigarettes?"
Ken asked when he returned.
"None."
Stuart opened the pillowcase, which was buried up to its throat in the dry ash which had filled the basement. He stuffed the bills in with the others and tied the pillowcase shut again.
"How about a game of chess?"
Ken propped himself up weakly, opened the wooden box of chessmen which he and Stuart had found in the wreckage of the house. Already he had managed to teach Stuart the rudiments of the game. Before the war, Stuart had never played.
"Nah," Stuart said.
He was watching, far off in the gray sky, the moving shape of some plane or rocket ship, a cylinder. God, he thought, could it be a bomb? Dismally, he watched it sink lower and lower. He did not even lie down, did not seek to hide as he had done that first time, in the initial few minutes on which so much, their being alive now, had depended.
"What's that?"
he asked. The dying man scrutinized it.
"It's a balloon."
Not believing him, Stuart said,
"It's the Chinese." "It really is a balloon. A little one. What they used to call a blimp, I think. I haven't seen one since I was a boy."
"Could the Chinese float across the Pacific in balloons?"
Stuart said, imagining thousands of such small, gray, cigar-shaped balloons, each with a platoon of Mongolian-type Chinese peasant soldiers, armed with Czech automatic rifles, clutching handholds, clinging to every fold.
"It's just what you'd expect them to think up from the beginning. They reduced the world to their level back a couple centuries, instead of catching up with us."
He broke off, because now he saw that the balloon had on its side in English, "Hamilton Air Force Base." The dying man said dryly,
"It's one of ours."
"I wonder where they got it," Stuart said.
"Ingenious," the dying man said, "isn't it? I suppose all the gasoline and kerosene are gone by now. Used right up. We'll be seeing a lot of strange transportation from now on. Or rather, you will."
"Stop feeling sorry for yourself," Stuart said.
"I don't feel sorry for myself or anyone," the dying man said as he carefully laid out the chess pieces. "This is a nice set," he said. "Made in Mexico, I notice. Hand carved, no doubt, but very fragile."
"Explain to me again how the bishop moves," Stuart said.
Overhead, the Hamilton Air Force Base balloon loomed larger as it drifted closer. The two men in the basement bent over their chessboard, paying no attention to it. Possibly it was taking pictures, or possibly it was on a strategic mission. It might have a walkie-talkie aboard and was in contact with the 6th Army unit south of San Francisco. Who knew? Who cared? The balloon drifted by as the dying man advanced his king's pawn 2 spaces to open the game.
"The game begins," the dying man said.
And then he added in a low voice,
"For you, anyhow, Stuart. A strange, unfamiliar new game ahead. You can even bet your pillowcase of money if you want."
Grunting, Stuart pondered his own men and decided to move a rook's pawn as his opening gambit, and knew as soon as he had touched it that it was an idiotic move.
"Can I take it back?"
he asked hopefully.
"When you touch a piece, you must move it," Ken said, bringing out one of his knights.
"I don't think that's fair. I mean, I'm just learning," Stuart said.
He glared at the dying man, but the sallow face was adamant.
"Okay,"
he said resignedly, this time moving his king's pawn, as Ken had done. "I'll watch his moves and do what he does," he decided. "That way I'll be safer." From the balloon, now directly overhead, bits of white paper scattered, drifted, and fluttered down. Stuart and the dying man paused in their game. One of the bits of paper fell near them in the basement, and Ken reached and picked it up. He read it, passed it to Stuart.
"Burlingame,"
Stuart said, reading it. It was an appeal for volunteers for the Army.
"They want us to hike from here to Burlingame and be inducted? That's 50 or 60 miles, all the way down this side of the bay and around. They're nuts."
"They are," Ken said. They won't get a soul.
Why, hell, I can't even make it down to Lecotte Street to the relief station, Stewart said.
He felt indignant, and he glared at the Hamilton Field balloon as it drifted on. They're not going to get me to join up, he said to himself. Fork that.
It says, Ken said, reading the proclamation, that if you reach Burlingame, they guarantee you water, food, cigarettes, anti-plague shots, treatment for radiation burns. How about that? But no girls.
Can you get interested in sex? He was amazed. Christ, I haven't felt the slightest urge since the first bomb fell. It's like the thing dropped off in fear, fell right off.
That's because the diencephalic center of the brain suppresses the sex instinct in the face of danger, Ken said. But it'll return.
No, Stewart said, because any child born would be a freak. There shouldn't be any intercourse for, say, around 10 years. They ought to make it a law. I can't stand the idea of the world populated by freaks, because I've had personal experience. One worked at Modern TV Sales with me, or rather in the service department. One was enough. I mean, they ought to hang that Bluthgeld up by his balls for what he did.
What Bluthgeld did in the 70s, Ken said, is insignificant when compared to this.
He indicated the ruins of the basement around them.
I'll grant you that, Stewart said. But it was the start.
Overhead now, the balloon was drifting back the way it had come. Perhaps it had run out of little messages and was returning to Hamilton Field, over on the other side of the bay, or wherever it was. Gazing up at it, Stewart said,
Talk to us some more.
It can't, Ken said. That's all it had to say. It's a very simple creature. Are you going to play, or should I move your pieces? Either is satisfactory to me.
With great caution, Stewart moved a bishop, and again knew at once that it had been the wrong move. He could tell by the dying man's face. In the corner of the basement, among the cement blocks, something agile and frightened plopped to safety, scurried and twittered with anxiety as it spied them. Stewart's attention wandered from the board to the rat, and he looked about for his broom handle.
Play!
Ken said angrily.
Okay, okay, Stewart said, feeling grumpy about it.
He made a random move, his attention still on the rat.